Welcome to On DoD, sponsored by Hewlett-Packard Enterprise on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, here's your host, Jared Serbu.
And thanks for listening this week. We'll start the program this time with a major workforce initiative now underway within the Air Force. The commander of Air Force Space Command has ordered what he calls a transformation involving virtually all the crews that maintain and operate the U.S. military satellites and other space-based capabilities, restructuring several Air Force wings into a new construct called the Space Mission Force. Later in the program, we'll switch gears to cybersecurity. Paul Stockton, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense, will join us to talk about a new presidential policy directive aimed at better coordination of the U.S.'s response to cyber attacks, the hurdles involved in actually implementing that directive, and the implications of a coordinated cyber attack on several elements of U.S. critical infrastructure all at once. First, though, the Space Mission Force. As I mentioned a moment ago, that transition is underway. The concepts were laid out in some detail in a new white paper by General John Hyten, the commander of Space Command. It involves new, more rigorous training, new measures of readiness that are designed to more closely align with how the Air Force presents its combat air forces to combatant commanders around the world. That's happening through an element of the Space Mission Force called the Ready Space Crew Program. Our guest to explain some of the thinking behind the Space Mission Force and how it'll affect airmen is Colonel Dean Snigowski. He's the Total Force Lead for the Space Mission Force at Air Force Space Command. Start us off, if you would, by just talking about why we're doing what we're doing here. I mean, from a manning and training perspective, why were the constructs that we had for the space enterprise not sufficient for the future that you all see coming down the pike?
Well, Air Force Space Command, you know, really has a long history of providing, you know, space capabilities, vital to the defense of our nation. The training and skills that sustained our space operations for the last few decades are not the same skills we need today to win in the environment that's contested, degraded, and operationally limited, as we've seen. This is why we're transforming our culture, and really it is a culture change, and I'll speak more to that a little bit later, but Space Mission Force is the answer, and space is no longer a sanctuary where Space Command and our mission partners can operate without interference. In the future, our adversaries who are intent on disrupting or denying access to our space capabilities are going to attempt to oppose risks at a pace we have not yet seen yet, and we got to prepare for it. We've already seen some countries perform live testing of anti-satellite weapons capabilities in removing their own spacecraft, and if they have the ability to destroy their systems, they can destroy ours. Space Mission Force construct allows us to revamp our crews to better respond to threats in a dynamic environment, and it really is going to help our crews balance experience and training, better support the combatant commander requirements, and that's really what's behind Space Mission Force.
Since you teed up the culture piece, let me just ask you to go ahead and expand on that right now. What is the current culture that we have now versus the end state that you're trying to achieve?
Well, our current culture, our operators, our space crew members are really, they're outstanding, top-notch, world-class members of the Air Force. They're more talented and better educated than ever before. They have a thorough knowledge of how the system operates. They can detect and fix anomalies and faults, but they're a little bit lacking in the adversary threats, you know, the different things that can be done to our systems that they need to work around. So we're trying to get them to that point where if they see a fault or an anomaly, that it might not be that fault. It could be adversary action. They might have to work around that threat.
And I'll ask you to get a little bit more specific on that in a second.
Sure,
but we should zoom out for a minute. And why don't you give us some sense of the, you know, the size of the overall workforce that you're trying to transform here? And since you have the words total force in your duty title, how do the Guard and Reserve play into this construct?
Well, the Guard and Reserve are very instrumental to this because the amount of mission space and a lot of the continuity and expertise reside in the Guard and Reserve as well. A little bit older of a force, a little bit more seasoned, if you will, but they're part of this Space Mission Force implementation as well. They're going to be, you know, shoulder to shoulder working with the REGAF, regular Air Force crew members, and supporting Space Mission Force as far as from the mission planning standpoint to advanced training to actually operating the system. So they'll be there as part of all mission areas. And a lot of our space forces do have reserve and guard support right now. And so they're going to be part of this endeavor. They're going to bring the adversary actions, that piece, and start reacting and training to be able to fight through that contested, deny, and operation limited environment.
You mentioned earlier that, and just now, actually, that the current culture really isn't that well equipped to deal with that thinking adversary. Is that just a matter of, you know, there already being some of those skill sets resident within the Air Force and you just don't have enough capacity in that respect? Or do you have to start from scratch here and build new doctrine, build new training, and create an entirely new concept here?
Not at all. You know, our like I said earlier, our operators are fantastic. They just haven't looked through it through that lens before. They were more concerned about operating the system properly, maintaining the health and wellness of the constellations, or if it's a space warning system or a missile warning system, making sure that the system is working properly and providing that primary mission. We're teaching them how to look at it from a different point of view, taking a step back and looking at what the adversaries can do to us, not only terrestrially, but you know, whether it's on space or even cyberspace, to complicate their mission and accomplishing their job. You know, they're smart and talented individuals on crew, but it's just a different way of looking at the threats that are out there.
As a practical matter, then, what does this actually mean for members of space crews in terms of the time that they spend training, the kinds of training that they do, and the dwell time in between those training cycles?
Well, right, so far, the 50th Space Wing is the first to implement. They went back to they started SMF back in February. The 21st has implemented part of it this past July, and the 614th and the 460th will transition to Space Mission Force next year. Really not going to change as far as personnel, but the duration of the SMF cycles, as you talked about, right now the 50th is doing 4 month rotation, with the first 4 months being called what is the Space Mission Task Force, essentially the day-to-day mission of the squadron they're accomplishing. And really what that's trying to do is separate all the extraneous activities that we levy on our crew force as far as admin. Even we try to encourage them not to take leave during those time frames or pursue professional military education. And then when they come to their dwell cycle is really when we start getting that advanced training piece, and we bring that on board, get them into exercise support such as Red Flag, where they can exercise those adversary threats and start looking at, you know, what the bad guys are trying to do to disrupt their mission. Gives them the opportunity to think outside the box and really dive into what the bad guys want to do to us and how to work around that. So it's going to be different for every wing depending on the mission that they support. But right now, 4 months is kind of the on-off, is a template. It's going to be different for the different wings depending on the mission that they provide. This is a different way. We're really starting to get our folks into a mission plan, execute, and then debrief way to execute our forces. This is unique in the space world. This is much more like the CAF, but we're getting to the point where that debrief, there's so many lessons learned from that piece. And it's a bit of a culture change. Our weapons officers, who are world-class as well, are the ones that are helping us with this the most, because they have this training. They've been out to our weapons school and fought with the CAF, and they understand how to do this properly. So that culture change is really what we're starting to sell to our space crew members. And they're, for the most part, they're really embracing it and getting into the way Space Mission Force is being executed. And then they're re-blueing them a little bit, getting them more involved in adversary threats and looking at it as a combat response. So it's really exciting, and it's, to use a fun word, it's cool. I mean, it's just great to see them have that combat edge.
Let me throw one more question in here then, because it made me think of something else.
No worries. Absolutely.
So much of what you're doing with your space-based capabilities has such a close connection to cyber. So how much of everything that the Space Mission Force is going to be doing is going to be interwoven with what the 24th Air Force is doing and other cyber components of the Air Force?
Well, I have to be completely honest with you. The 24th and cyber, there's something called Cyber Mission Force out there as well. So they're starting to take this approach to how they conduct their operations. I don't want to get too deep into the cyber threat because I'm getting outside of my lane.
Yeah.
However, as you well know, cyber affects everything. It is integrated in all our systems. It's part of our lives today. So whether it's your cell phone or your home computer or your work computer, not to mention the systems, cyber is out there. It is a threat, and it definitely falls along the threat matrix that we need to address. But not getting too much deep into it, it is a threat. We are aware of it, and there are folks that are working to better show that threat as well and to work through that contested, denied, operation limited cyber environment as well.
That's Colonel Dean Snigowski, the Total Force Lead for the Space Mission Force at Air Force Space Command. We'll come back and talk more about the Space Mission Force, the Ready Space Crew program, and how the Air Force is trying to change its thinking to adapt to that contested space environment the Colonel mentioned. Back in just a moment on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. This is on DoD. Thanks for listening to On DoD on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM in the National Capital Region and worldwide on the American Forces Network. We're talking in this part of the program about the Air Force's new Space Mission Force. What that service says is a transformation affecting all of its space crews. The transition's already underway within the 50th Space Wing based at Shriver Air Force Base in Colorado, and the nearby 21st and 460th Space Wings are following suit later this year. We're talking with Colonel Dean Snigowski, the Total Force Lead for the Space Mission Force at Air Force Space Command. The white paper talks about changes in the way that you actually present ready forces to combatant commanders. So which COCOMs are we really talking about here? Is this mainly STRATCOM that's going to be doing the tasking for these individual space crews, or could you have CENTCOM, for example, say, I want to be able to achieve these space effects in my AOR, please help me out?
Well, the main customer, of course, is a warfighter. You know, United States Strategic Command is going to be able to distribute those resources and effects to the combatant commanders as required. So any kind of tasking will be, you know, brought through STRATCOM. But STRATCOM serves to address warfighter concerns across the globe. So, yes, STRATCOM is our main node, but it's going to be distributed to all the different combatant commanders based on a needs requirement.
And the paper also talks about, and you referenced this earlier in our conversation, that one of the objectives of the Space Mission Force being able to deny the capability to freely operate in space if necessary, denying that capability to an adversary. Can you talk a bit more about what that denial approach sort of looks like as you sort through these concepts?
Absolutely. We want to have the ability to utilize our space resources and to operate at a time and a manner that we deem necessary for operational requirements. We want to make sure that the enemy does not dictate when we do things, where we do things, and how we do things. So part of the Space Mission Force is to teach our operators how to maximize the effects that our systems have and to use them at the need and the requirement of the combatant commander to achieve the goals of the mission that they're supporting at that time. Is really what we're looking for there.
This effort seems like it's mostly centered, or most of the implications of it really are on the workforce. But I wonder if this transformation that you've been talking about has any implications for the way the Air Force acquires space-based capabilities or what it acquires.
Well, there really shouldn't be too much as far as acquisitions. We need to invest more in our aggressor and our range support that works directly with our space forces and to train them, to get them better, to become more polished at their craft. But there are some needs for different simulators to integrate into the live virtual constructive environment for exercises. Our systems have got to be able to show the operator that something that might be an anomaly is actually adversary action. And this really goes for our operational system as well as our simulators, so they can differentiate between there's something wrong to there's something wrong because the adversary is trying to do something to us. And that's really probably the biggest acquisition question that is going to arrive from this. The training piece is big, and we are addressing that, you know, robustly. But we need to make sure that our systems are telling us the truth, and the enemy has a vote, and we have to make sure we can detect that and work through that CDO, that's contested, denied, operational limited environment. So, but it shouldn't be a large bill as far as acquiring brand new systems moving forward.
And what's the timeline look like for this entire transformation? You mentioned a couple wings are in the process already. When do you expect this total, keep going back to the word transformation, but when do you expect this entire effort to be completed, if it ever will be completed?
Well, we're going to keep reassessing it to make sure we're doing it right. And this really mirrors what the rest of the combat Air Force does as far as how they present their forces. So we're trying to get to that point. It will be continue to be worked on and refined as we go forward. But to answer just kind of the nuts and bolts of your question, you know, the last wing is expected to transition to Space Mission Force, fall of 17. And of course, we're already in the first SMTF and a half of the 50th, and we've learned so much already, and we're implementing that and putting it in the guidance and the regulations and all the directives that support the mission to make sure we capture those lessons learned and we apply them to the transformation and ensure that the next one's better than the last one, and then the next one after that's better than the next one as well. And we're not doing this in a vacuum. We're making sure that the lessons learned from the 50th Space Wing are transferred to the 21st Space Wing, and therefore is transferred to the 460th. So we're taking all these things, refining it, and getting it into a product that meets General Hyten's intent and is looking like the Space Force that he wants us to become.
Yeah, and let me pick up on something that you just said, because another thing that's brought up in the white paper is that you want, you use the word mirror, but you want the Space Mission Force to more closely align with the way a commander is used to looking at, let's say, a fighter squadron in terms of the way that you measure readiness and various other things. Talk about that piece of the transformation for a bit, if you could. How is that different from the way that you're presenting forces today compared to how it's going to look in the future?
Absolutely. The CAF, the Flying Air Force, uses what they call a Ready Air Crew program. It's a program that takes all the tactics and the procedures and the techniques and all the requirements that aviator has to maintain their proficiency in their system, in as far as not just a, you know, stick and rudder, but also their weapon, their combat, their putting warheads on foreheads, part of their mission area. So we're adapting that with the Ready Space Crew program. And as you read in the white paper, it's essentially taking those tasks, those continuation training and advanced training, leveraging the weapons and tactics processes that we pull forth and getting those techniques, tactics, and procedures to properly execute in a contested, denied, operational limited environment. So it's really trying to codify that, make sure we know what our crew members need. And, you know, talking about adapting, this is another thing that's done yearly, and if not sooner, right? If they recognize a large hole in the training, they can go back, and it's called a Ready Space Crew program training message that comes out, and it will capture all these events that the space crew members need to accomplish to get to that next level. And then, like I said, if something big comes up, we can always take that back, reauthor it, and get it back out to the space crew members to make sure that they're addressing the proper threats and that they're ready to fight in the current environment, no matter what it is.
And finally, any budget implications that we would expect out of all the work that you're trying to do through the Ready Space Crew program and the Space Mission Force, or is it all basically going to be resourced with what you've got right now?
Well, it's essentially resource neutral. I mean, we're pushing for, as far as, you know, we talked about the space aggressors and the range squadrons for more support. But, you know, it's really going to be using the forces that we have now and just realigning them to look like the Space Mission Force. You know, we also see a lot of savings in the way we're presenting forces by going to this methodology. So is just to answer your overall question, no, it's not going to be a large hit on money and resources, but it's a different way of presenting the forces we do have on now.
Colonel Dean Snigowski is the Total Force Lead for the Space Mission Force at Air Force Base Command. He was good enough to join us by phone from the command's headquarters at Peterson Air Force Base near Colorado Springs. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the Air Force published a fair amount of detail about where it's headed with the new Space Mission Force and why it's doing what it's doing via a new white paper by General John Hyten, the commander of Space Command. We will link to that document at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. We'll change topics when we come back from a short break. Some analysis on the new presidential policy directive designed to help agencies coordinate their responses to cyber attacks. Dr. Paul Stockton, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense, will join us. That's next on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbian. Thanks for listening to FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. As we pivot from the Air Force's new approach to training its space personnel to the overall U.S. response to cyber attacks, the Obama administration has just published a new presidential policy directive intended to help coordinate federal agencies' response plans and tell individual companies exactly who to call in the event of a breach or a major incident. Dr. Paul Stockton is the former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense. He's now managing director at the private firm Sonicon and a member of the Homeland Security Advisory Council. In that last capacity, he's just finished work on a new report exploring the implications of a cyber attack against multiple different sectors of U.S. critical infrastructure, perhaps the power grid, the telecommunications system, the financial sector, all at once, a scenario the council says is increasingly likely.
Individual critical infrastructure sectors, the electricity subsector, the financial subsector, the communications sector, as individual sectors, they're making significant progress in being able to make their systems more resilient against attack. That is, less vulnerable to attack, and if an attack does occur, they're able to more quickly restore service than they would have been a few years ago. So individual sectors are making major progress. The challenge lies in cross-sector resilience. Each of these sectors depend on each other. Let me give you a prime example.
Mm-hmm.
The electricity sector absolutely needs to be able to provide power to the communication sector so communications can function. But if a major blackout occurs, the electric power companies, utilities, are going to need communications in order to be able to conduct restoration operations. There's a risk of multiple failures where the failure of one sector cripples the ability of another sector to restore services. So we need to be prepared and make progress in the realm of cross-sector support. So each sector is ready not only to take care of its own restoration operations, but can help other sectors on which they depend conduct prioritized support operations. So from a cross-sector perspective, everybody's going to be able to help out each other.
And so one of the issues then is that DHS has not adequately built those interdependencies into its response plans?
The opportunity going forward is the National Cyber Incident Response Plan, which DHS is revising and improving right now, will be able to take these cross-sector interdependencies into account and especially be able to ensure that government can effectively interface with multiple sectors instead of one at a time. But the first step for progress is for these industries themselves to get together and begin to collaborate in preparing for restoration plans that, again, look beyond their own sector. A significant progress is underway. The financial sector, for example, has an exercise series called the Hamilton Series, where increasingly the financial services sector is inviting in electric power companies and other sector representatives, communications, to participate in these exercises. And now I think we're seeing the beginnings of more and more progress by industries to build this collaborative framework. That's the first step. The second step is to make sure that the federal government is ready to be able to handle an attack on multiple sectors simultaneously, and that the coordination mechanisms and the communications links to be able to handle a cross-sector, a multi-sector attack are in place and can survive against a determined adversary.
And I know you've also written about the fact that cyber weapons, you know, zero-day exploits in particular, are increasingly bought and sold on the black market. They're not just for nation states anymore. Does that include the kinds of tools that you would need to pull off this kind of multi-domain cyber attack on critical infrastructure? Or is the kind of all-out assault that you were just talking about still kind of the realm of foreign governments?
There is an uncontrolled black market underway today that enables terrorist organizations to buy increasingly sophisticated cyber weapons off the dark web. Anybody who has the money can get access to very advanced attack capabilities today. And so what we see is a growing range of potential adversaries have access to increasingly sophisticated cyber weapons. The United States needs to be concerned about potential nation-state adversaries, but increasingly the range of potential attackers who could launch a multi-sector attack is growing, and we need to be out in front of that. Again, individual industries, individual sectors are doing quite well in most cases in building their preparedness. We need to accelerate the progress in multi-sector support.
I just coincidentally, on a very related topic, as we're sitting here taping, I'm just seeing a press release come into my inbox from Tom Carper, the ranking member on this Senate Homeland Security Committee, asking DHS basically to look into designating the U.S. election system as critical infrastructure. Evidently worried that if the DNC could be hacked, it's not a stretch to think that election machines could be too. Just to your knowledge, has that idea gotten much serious consideration within the government before? And do you have an opinion on whether that designation would be helpful or useful?
The attention focused on this problem at the federal level is increasing rapidly. But as you know, Jared, elections are under control of states and localities.
Sure.
Every state has its own system. Many localities have their own systems to determine which kinds of vendors are going to be selected to have particular kinds of voting machines and how security is going to be conducted. That brings in a very interesting challenge in resilience, and that is integrating the role of state and local governments into overall critical infrastructure security. We traditionally look to the Department of Homeland Security in order to provide overall federal coordination to support industry cybersecurity. I think going forward, including in the National Cyber Incident Response Plan, it's critically important that we bring governors and other state and local leaders to the table so that as they exercise their constitutional responsibilities to provide for the public health and safety of their citizens and also to manage elections, that these responsibilities and roles are integrated in an effective way into our overall approach to secure our election systems from attack.
That's Dr. Paul Stockton, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense, now Managing Director at the private firm Sonicon and a member of the Homeland Security Advisory Council. We'll talk about the new presidential policy directive the Obama administration just issued, designed to get agencies on a better footing to respond to a cyber incident after one last break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbib. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. A few minutes left with Dr. Paul Stockton, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense, now Managing Director at the private firm Sonicon, and a member of the Homeland Security Advisory Council. As we talk about U.S. preparedness for a major cyber attack, perhaps one that hit multiple elements of U.S. critical infrastructure all at once. Let's turn to Presidential Policy Directive 41, just a couple weeks old now. We reported on it when it first came out, but it gets directly to a lot of the coordination issues that we've been talking about so far. Talk a bit, if you would, about how you see the effectiveness of that order from the White House, what it's going to take to make that a success, and some of the implementation hurdles that are still ahead.
PPD 41 marks a major step forward, but its ultimate effectiveness is going to depend on a multi-year effort to successfully implement the PPD. Let me tell you a couple of reasons why I think this directive is so valuable.
Please.
First of all, most obviously, it provides further clarification of the roles and responsibilities for different components of the federal government, including the intelligence community, the Department of Justice and the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security. That's very valuable. There's something else that I think is important going forward, and that is PPD 41 clarifies that multiple lines of effort are going to go forward simultaneously. That is, we're going to be able to have operations go forward to identify the potential attackers, do forensics analysis, while also simultaneously providing for the fastest possible restoration of services. These two functions can't be in opposition. We need to be able to do forensics, threat characterization, all of those law enforcement side activities simultaneously with the restoration of critical services on which public health and safety will depend.
And so this all coming in the form of a presidential policy directive in the waning months of the current administration, how durable do you think this roadmap or this framework will be, across different presidencies? Or is there a potential that, that the next administration comes in, throws it all out the window, and decides to pursue a different path?
I believe that the principles that the PPD is advancing are so fundamentally sound that regardless of which party wins the presidency, the PPD will provide a foundation for further progress. But again, implementation is going to be critical to success. It'll take many, many years deep into the next administration to accomplish the objectives that have been laid out of improved coordination and more effective response. And indeed, as the threat continues to intensify, both in terms of the sophistication of cyber weapons and the growing range of adversaries who can get access to those weapons, our response capabilities, our coordination mechanisms are going to need to keep improving as well. So this effort needs to go on long beyond the end of the Obama administration, into the next administration and beyond.
And moving beyond response and resiliency, I want to spend a couple minutes with you, Dr. Stockton, talking about deterrence. And in terms of deterring big nation states from launching attacks, I think one of the new-ish developments over the past couple years is that DOJ in particular has been more and more willing to share what it knows, what the intelligence community knows, really, about foreign intrusions, and then using that information in prosecutions and in sanctions. In your view, how effective has that strategy been in curbing the kind of activity that we don't like?
Well, naming and shaming, I think, is an important tool in our arsenal. But I think that there's also another realm in which progress needs to be sustained, and that is deterrence by denial. If the owners and operators of U.S. critical infrastructure can continue to strengthen the resilience of their systems, they're going to be able to create uncertainty in the minds of the adversaries as to whether those adversaries can achieve the goals that they have in attacking U.S. infrastructure in the first place. We can continue to make sure that our systems are so resilient that those resilience investments can make attacks less likely because they're less likely to be successful.
Yeah, and I suppose that also changes the cost-benefit analysis. Beyond creating uncertainty, you're also raising the cost of any potential attack.
Absolutely. As infrastructure owners and operators help ensure that the Department of Defense and other instruments of U.S. power can continue to operate effectively, despite their dependence on electric power grid and other civilian-owned and operated infrastructure. As those efforts go forward to assure that the federal government can do its jobs and keep the president able to use a wide variety of potential response tools, that ability to respond effectively pairs up very nicely with deterrence by denial and raising doubts in the minds of the adversary about whether the adversary's attacks are going to achieve the effects that they want.
Right. And on the naming and shaming point, I think a lot of the success that even DOJ would point to would seem to be around the area of a China, for example, stealing intellectual property just to help out their own companies, economic espionage, basically. I'm not sure that that alone has done much to deter a potential enemy from trying to steal actual state secrets like an OPM hack or maybe using cyber weapons in the context of a conflict. I don't know that naming and shaming gets you very far on that kind of thing.
I think there are different kinds of problems. So if we're concerned primarily about the risk of destructive attacks on critical infrastructure, the president has already said that the United States will use a full range of tools, not necessarily cyber responses, in order to be able to discourage such attacks. Those efforts need to continue to go forward. We need to be able to respond effectively and convince adversaries of our ability to do so, at the same time that we strengthen the resilience of our own systems to improve deterrence by denial.
Well, let me just finish up back on the coordination point. You know, after several years of calling for legislation, we do have some, the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act, which is now law. I'm wondering, just based on your experiences with the companies that you've worked with and in your capacity on the advisory council, have you seen any marked difference in companies' willingness to share information with each other and with the government as a direct result of that law?
Yes, I think sharing is improving. That's partly due to the legislation that Congress has enacted, but also I think that owners and operators of critical infrastructure are increasingly committed to improving sharing because they understand that the threat is so serious and that their ability to respond effectively depends on effective sharing of information that an attack has occurred, the characterization of that attack, and ultimately how to make sure that industries can scrub the malware that's been embedded on their systems to ensure that systems can come up effectively and stay up.
And back where we started on sharing information across critical infrastructure sectors, you mentioned, for example, that the sector-specific coordinating body for electricity had reached out to other sectors. Is that really the main way that this cross-sector sharing is going to have to go forward, these existing bodies reaching out to one another, or does there need to be a new overarching cross-industry coordinating body where all this comes together?
All of the above. So within sectors and subsectors such as electricity, important progress is being made to share information, including in automated ways, machine-to-machine sharing of threat intelligence, warning information that could be incredibly valuable. But as you point out, it's not sufficient for individual sections of the economy to be able to share information. Cross-sector sharing is going to be important, and that's why the progress being made under PPD 41 is going to be so important to provide for this cross-sector sharing of threat data.
Dr. Paul Stockton is a former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Homeland Defense, now Managing Director at the private firm Sonicon. He's also a member of the Homeland Security Advisory Council, where his subcommittee just issued a new report warning about the implications of a cyber attack that hit several different sectors of U.S. critical infrastructure all at once. We'll post a link to that report at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Colonel Dean Snigowski, the Total Force Lead for the Space Mission Force at Air Force Space Command. If you missed our conversation about the Space Mission Force and the new Ready Space Crew program, we'll post this week's full program, as always, at federalnewsradio.com. That's it for this week's edition of On DoD on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM in the National Capital Region, and worldwide on the American Forces Network. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for listening. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.